Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 347, recorded on February 2nd, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Today's guest is Justin Rozniak from Well, There's Your Problem, which is a colorful comedy podcast and slideshow series on engineering disasters, as well as the content creator behind the Do Not Eat 01 YouTube series that uses the city building simulator City Skylines to talk about urban policy and urban history from a leftist perspective. We have referred to episodes of these shows on our show previously, and oftentimes I hear a passing sentence from Justin in one of his videos that inspires me to do a bunch of research and produce a whole episode or multiple episodes on some industrial history topic. For this episode, we needed to get someone with a scientific engineering background, a history interest, and a leftist worldview on the program. So Justin, welcome to Arsenal for Democracy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for introducing me so I don't have to do any work.
Well, I aim to please. And, like I said, it is a really great show, or all of your shows are actually really great, and, has been a very positive influence on this show in the past couple of years. We used to do a lot more sort of current events stuff on this show, but for obvious reasons, that got less and less interesting. So we kind of pivoted to talking about a lot of industrial history. And, one of the episodes that I've frequently referred to on this show is the one that you did about the print media industry, because I really liked the way that you approached that, kind of the rise and fall of the print media industry and looking at sort of the industrial processes and labor inputs and things like that that affect the content that gets produced. I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at that topic. So today we're going to be climbing into our time machines and traveling to the far distant, technologically advanced electro-steampunk futurism of the United States in the year 1938, and before, I guess, which was an era when this country was a global leader in electrification of railroads, when electricity-powered trains were running side-by-side with steam trains, and when companies would compete to brag in advertising to the general public about the wonders of their electrified train equipment. And for this, we have both read the book, the second edition of the book, When the Steam Railroads Electrified, by William D. Middleton. This was originally published in 1974, but then had a 2002 update after Amtrak launched its Acela Express service. And it's important, I think, to emphasize that electrification of American railroads wasn't some kind of failure that we as a country had to walk back. There's a good quote from near the end of the book, which says, "In almost every instance, U.S. electrification was a huge success. Running times were reduced, tonnage capacities were increased. Electric locomotives delivered transportation at much lower fuel costs. Electric locomotive maintenance costs were a fraction of those for steam power. Their availability was two or three times greater, and their effective service lines lives promised to be twice as long as those of steam locomotives. In many cases, the savings resulting from electric operation were sufficient to repay the cost of electrification in as little as 5 years." So, Justin, I guess as an overview point on this, why do you think it is that it's sort of like seen in the U.S., which is certainly not the case in other countries, that electrification of things like railroads is like, some sort of futuristic technology as opposed to something that peaked in 1938 here?
I mean, I would honestly kind of say, maybe the way it's viewed, at least in the railroad industry, is kind of almost as a backwards technology, right?
Right.
But, railroad electrification is incredibly common everywhere else in the world, though, except here in the United States. It just seems like a completely infeasible thing because of people come up with all kinds of excuses, like the distances involved, like, you know, the you know, just the lack of population or whatever. And, you know, this is something which the Soviet Union could achieve in, on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. I don't know why we can't do it here.
Well, I guess maybe one of the things is that, you know, as opposed to some of these other countries or the early 20th century in the United States, almost any sort of infrastructure and capital projects in this country seem to have just ballooned in cost so much relative to how much it should actually cost to build them, that then that becomes, you know, kind of a huge deterrent when you are looking at, you know, sparser populations or longer distances. But I think also, as when this is something we're gonna talk about on this episode, I think there's also a perception in the United States among the general public that electrification of trains is for like passenger service, which we don't have like a huge amount of in this country, as opposed to what it was actually often used for, as we'll discuss, which was also freight service. I don't know why that is either, but that's sort of the perception. Maybe it's because we really only have, you know, the Acela and stuff like that that's for passengers, but people seem to think of it as being like that, in which case then you start talking about population densities and things like that.
Yeah. It's not commonly like looked at, you know, electrification as a solution for freight transportation, even though there's many corridors in the United States where I think right now it would make a lot of sense, you know, because freight traffic is increasing steadily, you know, and some of these corridors are seeing 100, 150 freight trains a day.
Yeah, there's definitely a case to be made for it being viable. But I think like looking back at the history of this is an interesting way of looking at it. As you said, in the industry, it's sort of perceived as this backwards step in some ways. But there was a period where this was like, you know, the cutting edge. This was going to be the future of American transportation. That 1938 U.S. peak that I mentioned came a century after the first experiments with electromagnetism in motive power, and 59 years after the first successful demonstrations of electrified third rail trains in 1879 in Germany, and then again in 1880 in the U.S. Electrification of existing rail service began in 1885 in Baltimore. And initially, the electrification focus was around urban street railways, which I think I'll probably do a separate episode on because I didn't want to get us bogged down on that. But as early as 1887, in Pennsylvania, a coal freight line was electrified. By the time of the Columbian Exposition in 1893, the same year as overhead wire rail service was beginning, General Electric was making grandiose proclamations of the dawn of a thousand-year reign for electrified rail service. I thought that was crazy. There was some ad that was quoted in the book where they were talking about the millennium of electrified rail, which was really aiming high.
I was about to say, well, I mean, the flying cars haven't happened, so I think electric railroads are probably the best we got.
Well, and that's another thing, too. I mean, you think about like the stuff that gets hyped up so much now, whether it's flying cars or even much more mundane self-driving cars. And that's like such a pipe dream technology compared to rail, electrified rail, which we can do. Like, that's the thing. We've known how to do it for a long time and make it viable, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is old technology, which works extremely well. But, you know, God forbid, you know, you invest in something that requires a bit of capital investment when maybe next year there'll be some kind of innovation which makes it obsolete. I mean, it hasn't been rendered obsolete in the past 100 years. I don't know why it would suddenly be obsolete now. But
right. So there, like I said, the sort of the beginning of real serious electrified rail service was in the 1890s. And then it continued, as I said, until the late 1930s. What is sort of the broad strokes picture that people should understand about that period from the 1890s to the 1930s in terms of rail electrification? I mentioned that quote about sort of all the benefits that were achieved by it, but what are some of the sort of the highlights there?
So early railroad electrification, a lot of it was in pursuit of either smoke abatement, or sometimes it was for you know, high traffic densities. But the early stuff, you know, it's kind of experimental. It's also for, smoke abatement in tunnels was a big one. And results were extremely surprising to start out with. Folks thought, you know, this tiny little, you know, you'd have a tiny little electric locomotive that looked kind of pathetic, and it could, you know, outpull any steam locomotive. It turned out to have much lower maintenance costs. It was much less labor intensive. like all of a sudden this electrification that seemed like a gimmick, you know, suddenly looked like a real practical alternative to steam power, because there are lots of problems with steam locomotives. They're very labor intensive. They take a while to fire up in the morning. They are maintenance nightmares, and the electric locomotive just were not. So in sort of like the late 1890s, early 1900s, there's definitely, no one knows exactly what to do with these electric locomotives, but they certainly seem to be working extremely well. So, you know, some railroads start to say, well, maybe we should extend the electric wires or the electric third rail out a little bit farther and see what happens. And, you know, this results in a couple of big systems putting up lots and lots of wires.
Something that my dad was commenting on is that one of the reasons that a sort of patchwork electrification was viable as opposed to sort of electrifying entire systems right off the bat was that there was a limited range on a lot of the steam locomotives at the time. So frequently they would be switching the locomotives every 100 miles or so anyway. So if you had a particularly, you know, whether it was a tunnel stretch or a mountain stretch or something like that, if you had one stretch where electrification made sense, you could do that without having to electrify everything, which I guess I wouldn't have thought of that necessarily as being the case. I think today people would say, oh, you got to electrify the whole thing, which also probably isn't really true with current technology either.
I mean, yeah, if you were running a steam railroad, if a train had to go over, let's say, the Appalachian Mountains, you know, you might have some sections where there's one locomotive on the front. You might have a section where once we get to a grade, you got to put another steam locomotive on the front. Maybe you get to a really steep grade, you got to put another locomotive on the back. And, you know, these trains were assembled, disassembled, you know, recombinated, whatever, all through their trip versus. And that's why, yeah, you could just pop an electric locomotive on there for the steep part or the tunnel, and that made sense. Today you don't do that so much. You know, a train might run from like Los Angeles to Chicago with the same locomotive, and you know, there'll just be a stop somewhere like halfway for refueling, and that's it.
Right. So you and I both live on the Northeast Corridor, but of course your section was electrified a lot earlier than my section. You know, I'm up here in the Boston area, and I remember in the late 90s when they finally extended the electrification of Amtrak from New Haven, Connecticut to Boston. That had never previously happened. There were various problems with the New Haven Railroad in the early 20th century when it was working on electrifying that line. They had done some like shorter electrifications around the Boston area, but not, you know, linking up to the rest of their system. Those extra 156 route miles to Boston took 90 years to get done, and that was maybe one of two or so expansions to rail electrification undertaken in the U.S. between the late 1930s and the year 2000. One thing, the book attributes that sort of stalling out to the financial problems of the company related to its expensive mergers and acquisitions period. My dad was arguing that a bigger factor, or at least a factor in that, was the slowing down of that sort of regional consolidation process, Louis Brandeis and so forth, trying to stop the regional monopolization in New England by the New Haven Railroad. I was wondering kind of what your thoughts were on what the reason was that in that particular case that things kind of stalled out. You know, was it that they were just couldn't make the capital expenses work, or, you know, was it that they... Trust busting is something that obviously comes up on a lot of like left and liberal podcasts these days, is like, is that good or not? And in some cases, you know, having a unified system maybe makes it easier to do some of this stuff in a way that isn't true if it's not allowed to do that.
I would say that the New York, New Haven and Hartford Railroad was a disaster show of an organization throughout like the 20th century, because it was essentially a monopoly on traffic. I mean, practically speaking, despite attempts to sort of get some competition in there, the railroad was a monopoly in New England for, you know, passenger and freight transportation. But in addition to that, it was also in constant financial dire straits. You know, it was it never it, after like the 30s, had never really made money, you know, so you had only one option for shipping rail freight, and that option was bad.
Well, the reason that I'm asking that, though, is also that I was noticing, at least toward the end of the book, that they, one of the factors that was cited in terms of impediments to early electrification, which would probably be less of an issue now, but was certainly something that slowed things down then, was a lack of industry standardization. I mean, that's something that comes up a lot when you talk about the Second Industrial Revolution, and of course, Standard Oil literally having it in the name, was, you know, this idea that through trusts and cartels and monopolies, we can achieve standardization. Obviously, could have also been done if the government had ever stepped in at any point and said, yes, you know, here's what the standards are. But of course, that's a deeply unfair central planning by the government in the market, and you have to let the central planning happen at the corporate level instead. I was just wondering what your thoughts were, because on page 414, it talks about there was lack of industry standardization on currents, voltages, equipment, catenary, third rail, etc., and it was very hard to kind of figure out, like, what is going to be the standard, what should we put on our system, is it going to link up with the other systems? Almost feels like an echo of those earlier gauge wars, which I think you've talked about on your show as well, where, you know, they hadn't even standardized what gauge was going to be the one that trains typically ran over. So then you'd have to unload all your cargo when you got to a different railroad.
Yeah, I mean, there were only a few, I think, areas where, you know, standardization of electrical systems would have made a difference, and that was mostly in New York City, of course. You know, where they have the Long Island Railroad uses a separate third rail system from Metro North, which uses a third rail system and overhead wire. But I think the voltages are different on each side of Penn Station. It's very confusing. But I, a lot of these systems, if they had all been standardized, you may have seen some more attempts to link them up, right? But even where, you know, systems were built to similar standards, they didn't necessarily actually get linked up. I think a good example is the Virginian Railway and the Pennsylvanian Railroad, because they used the same electrical system. They were not separated by too much distance, but no one ever thought to go and say electrify the Richmond, Fredericksburg, and Potomac Railroad, which, you know, would have gotten them much closer together, maybe allow some through running electric trains. I would wonder, like, I don't know if it was, I don't know how many systems were close enough together that standardization would have made a huge difference.
Well, it sounds like what we needed to do was consolidate them all into one giant railroad, and it could also be run by one giant union.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk more specifically about the Pennsylvania, which you just alluded to, and of course, this is in more your neck of the woods in Philadelphia. They kind of really became associated with electrification in a way that a lot of the railroads did not. For them, electrification was the key to unlocking capacity without needing to build more trackage, because you would get your trains would be sped up on the main lines and then the switching yards and the stations, or you could just even pull longer trains with more passenger cars or more freight cars and so forth. Pennsylvania Railroad electrification also ended up being one of the big, maybe few, private industry projects of the Great Depression. They also got federal assistance as well, but, you know, it was not directly a government program. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, it's kind of fascinating. They managed to put up some pretty blistering service speeds on their electrified trains, especially with the GG1 locomotives in the mid-1930s. How fast were those electrified trains typically going? We're talking about almost a century ago, compared to both the steam alternatives and at the time, and also typical trains today. Again, to get to that point of sort of retrofuturism, where things have gotten worse instead of better with technological advances.
The fastest metro liner schedule was 1964, I think. And it was, I believe, about 5 minutes faster than the fastest current Acela schedule.
Cool.
Yeah. Those metro liner trains were not good. They broke down a lot, but they did run a faster schedule in the 60s than they do today. You were certainly running much, much faster than steam locomotives, because you weren't gonna maintain. There were very few steam locomotives that are able to maintain, you know, speeds upwards of 100 miles an hour for a sustained period of time.
Yeah, I mean, you always hear about those, like, test ones that they would do, or like exhibition ones, especially in Britain. I think they had some of those, like, you know, where they would say, oh, well, look at our, how fast our express passenger steam train can go. But like electrification just head and shoulders above that, basically.
Yeah, the only railroad that really tried to regularly run steam trains that fast was the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul and Pacific. And of course, they also dabbled in electrification. So, you know,
right. So setting aside electrification of urban streetcars and the effects that that had on urban electrification, because I want to get into that in a different episode. One interesting point in the chapter on the Pennsylvania Railroad electrification, which I was wondering if you had thoughts about, was that the PRR proved on the U.S. East Coast that rail electrification could by itself generate a huge amount of new business for power utility companies, which means that they can, those power companies can then expand their own operations and do more things. I think it was speculated at the time, but mostly never came to pass, that if the U.S. had electrified railroads through much of its more rural areas, that might have actually sped up the electrification for the general population in those regions. Because, of course, this is the time period where we're talking about, like, you know, still having trouble getting electrification for consumers and so forth into Appalachia and places like that. It seems like that, you know, one of the themes that I've talked about on a lot of recent episodes of the show is that if you can get one big customer guaranteed for something, you know, for some capacity thing, whether it's a new factory or a new utility company or whatever, that can then allow them to expand service to consumers for other things. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, just because I thought that was kind of an interesting side point or side effect of the Pennsylvania Railroad's electrification project.
It's interesting that the Pennsylvania Railroad bought most of its power from local utilities, and I believe the Northeast Corridor, they still buy their power from local utilities. It all has to be converted from 60 cycle AC to 25 cycle AC now, which is a pain in the ass. But the yeah, if you have if railroads electrified, you would definitely have seen rural electrification happen a lot more quickly, because, you know, a lot of these railroads go through the middle of goddamn nowhere.
Right.
And you would need utilities to supply that power. So I mean, but you would have needed, you know, some kind of, I think, really federal intervention to have gotten widespread electric power, electric powered railroads to have happened, right? I mean, a lot of these railroads were sort of on the verge of going all in. I think if there were just a tiny nudge from the federal level at the right time, you would have seen a lot more miles of wire go up. But, you know, again, that did not happen, unfortunately.
Something that I think you actually mentioned in a recent episode of Well, There's Your Problem, which is, again, just sort of a passing thing that you threw out there, and I caught on to it and was thinking about it in the context of this. What was generating power at the time, typically? I mean, there's a lot of mentions in the book, especially for the Western railroads, that they would be putting up, you know, hydroelectric dams and things like that, and then bragging about that as well, right? You know, not only do we have this cutting edge technology on our trains, but we're also, you know, getting nature to power our rail system and so forth. Was this coal power plants? Was this wood? What was typically powering these at the time?
So a lot, and I mean a lot of power at that time was hydroelectric, right? Because, you know, dams are easy to build. There were still a lot of undammed rivers. There was a lot of unexploited hydroelectric power everywhere in the United States. Coal power as like a mass, a form of mass electricity generation was not super widespread until I think the 1960s. Before that, everything was hydro, or most of everything was hydro. A few railroads and utilities would build coal power plants, but it wasn't the most common thing.
Well, and this was, of course, before the woke salmon police rose up and prevented hydroelectrification.
Obviously, yes. And also the exploitation of Powder River Basin coal definitely accelerated the adoption of coal power.
Yeah, I think it was interesting when you mentioned that on your show recently, because I hadn't really thought about it. And I guess, yeah, coal would have been typically more of like a heating fuel, a boiler fuel for, you know, consumer purposes, industrial purposes, whatever. But that wouldn't have been typically what most of the power was actually being generated by until, you know, well after World War II.
Yeah, and then you had more advanced, like a modern coal power plant is certainly much, much more complicated than shoveling some coal in a furnace. You know, there's all kinds of processes they have to do to the coal. You know, coal power was not easily possible to do efficiently before World War II.
Now, you mentioned earlier about one of the advantages was that electric locomotives and so forth, the equipment just ran better, broke down less, etc., compared to steam locomotives. There were a couple of funny anecdotes, though, in the book, especially, I know you like the GG1 locomotive. I certainly am a big fan. I had a poster on my wall growing up of the Army-Navy game and so forth with all the locomotives lined up. And of course, I've been to the, is it still there in Harrisburg? Do they still have that one at the?
Yeah, they still have the one sitting there in Harrisburg. Amtrak threatened the Historical Society recently that they had to move their locomotive or they were going to do something to it.
Ooh.
But I don't think they followed through on that.
but this, you know, these real cool, sleek, fast GG1 1930s locomotives, very cool, generally quite reliable. But there were two sort of freak accidents that were, or like engineering problems, I'll say, because then we can talk about an accident. But in terms of engineering problems, tiny snowflakes and clouds of mayflies were apparently sufficient at one point to two different incidents to stop GG1s. I thought that was sort of a weird thing that happened. I mean, what are the odds of that, right?
I mean, that's an air intake problem. That could have happened to any locomotive. It just happened to happen to the GG1. You know, that was just one little problem they managed to fix.
I won't go into a huge amount of detail about the accident in 1953, because you've done an episode on your show about that, the Federal Express, where it crashed through the floor in Union Station in Washington, D.C. Fortunately, nobody was killed. But I was going to note, no one was killed. There were a bunch of injuries, but it did not actually affect the entire train equally. I may have mentioned this to you on Twitter previously, but my dad's friend, his father was on a business trip from Boston to Washington, and he was on that train and kind of, you know, a bit of an oblivious guy, and he was sitting near the back of the train, and he just, you know, got off the train, went about his business, not realizing it had crashed. Somebody had to call him later in the day and say, you know, where are you? Are you okay? Did you, you know, the train crashed. And meanwhile, the train is sitting, you know, half in the basement in a total wreck. And he's just, oh, I don't know. I thought it was a bit of a bumpy stop at the end, but just, you know, didn't apparently notice that at all. Anyway, definitely folks should check out your episode on, well, there's your problem. I'll put a link up with that to make sure people check out that episode. Just kind of a funny fluke accident, but in general, like, I think a lot of the electric ones were safer as well than some of the steam trains at the time, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, there's so many things that can go wrong on a steam locomotive, ranging from, you know, just general breakdowns because there's so many moving parts, or, you know, a boiler explosion, which, you know, murders everyone. And electric locomotive, I mean, seems like the worst that can really happen is you blow a fuse.
Before we head into talking about some of the other lines that were electrified, you know, as I know you're a fan of the Pennsylvania Railroad, I was wondering if you had any other sort of thoughts or observations about that that part of the book.
The Pennsylvania Railroad electrification, obviously, it's the most successful electrification in the United States. It's just I feel like it's a shame they didn't get out to Pittsburgh with it. I think we would see a radically different sort of railroading in the United States if that last segment had been finished, or not last segment, if it had made it out to Pittsburgh. I'm sure it would have gone farther. You know, this is one of those great what ifs, because I imagine we'd still probably see electric freight trains running today if they had made it that far, and probably much better passenger service on that segment from Harrisburg to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, is so remarkable to read about this is they're always comparing, like, well, here was the passenger running time with steam, here was the passenger running time once the Pennsylvania or whatever railroad had electrified, and then you think about, well, and here's what the time is for those same sections today. I mean, it's just, it's depressing, frankly.
Yes.
So one of the other points, as you just alluded to, is that, you know, we had this eastern section of rail electrification. And of course, there, you know, that did go beyond just the coast. Norfolk and Western electrified their Appalachian rail routes, as you mentioned earlier, beginning in the early 1910s. The improved speed and reduced need for locomotives with electrification over the mountains meant they were practically printing money relative to their old costs by the early 1920s. But after World War II, they tunneled to shorten the route and decided that was so much shorter and easier that they didn't need to electrify the new route. And then, you know, by the 1960s, mergers made it kind of redundant or less desirable to have electrified service through Appalachia. But it's not just the case that this was an East Coast thing. That's what I think a lot of people think of, because the Northeast Corridor is basically what's left of this. But it was the case that there was a lot of electrification or experiments with electrification in the western part of the United States as well. The Northern Pacific looked to electrification of the Cascades, both for its climbing power and its lack of smoke and heat in the long mountain tunnels, which almost asphyxiated train crews and passengers, apparently. And by 1909, again, much earlier than I think a lot of people might think if they'd not really looked into this, the Northern Pacific had electrified a section. And once that was proven, that actually allowed them to build other electrified tunnels to save distance and climbing in the late 1920s. Could you talk a little bit about that sort of mountaineering aspect of the electrification of rail? Again, I think people think of it as, you know, this seaboard type of thing for passenger service or whatever. In this case, we're talking about both passenger and freight service, and just, you know, the benefits were so much clearer in these extreme mountain conditions, which people might not think of that necessarily.
Yeah, it's interesting that there is, I would say, almost no cases where you don't get an advantage from electrifications. I mean, the you know, when you have, one of the nice things you can do with electric trains and is you have regenerative braking, right? You just turn, you flip the polarity on the electric motor, and it turns into a generator as opposed to a motor, and then you can then you're generating electricity by slowing down the train, right? And
kind of like the hybrid car technology, right? I mean, that was sort of with the early, like, Priuses, people would always be like, oh, look, if I press on the brakes as I'm coming up to an intersection, I'm actually generating power.
Yeah, it's this incredible, it's marketed as like an incredible modern innovation and like Teslas and crap. And it's like, well, no, we've been doing this since 1905. Y'all are just late to the party.
Right.
But when you have, you know, big heavy mountain grades and stuff like that, you know, you're going up the mountain and then back down the mountain. That means you're using a lot of power on the way up, but you're returning that power on the way down. So you have energy efficiency gains that way, which you couldn't, you know, you're turning all your braking power into electricity. I mean, when this is probably not strictly accurate, but the story always went that when the Milwaukee Road sent the first train over, I want to say one of their mountain divisions, they got the bill from the electric company, and the electric company owed them $17.
Again, this was happening a lot, and I have to keep emphasizing this, a lot earlier than I think most of the general public would be aware of. I mean, we're talking about, you know, again, 1909 for the Northern Pacific electrification, and then the Milwaukee Road electrification that you were just talking about. That was almost right after that. This was, you know, the beginning of the 20th century still. They built a route over the Rocky Mountains and the Cascades to connect their Midwest core operations with West Coast seaport access, and they were, you know, decided to electrify it because, well, partly because they were tied to a copper mining interest, and that's a lot of copper that you get if you electrify. You know, you need to buy a whole bunch of copper. It's 17 tons yes. a mile. So that was, you know, some more monopoly and cartel power there in effect. But also just because that tractive power of electric locomotives over the mountains and, you know, not having those cold weather problems with the steam engines, you know, not having those tunnel smoke issues, all of this. It could not be beaten. And this is, again, this was happening in the 1910s. And once again, we see the power companies they're contracting with are then able to significantly expand their capacity and operations in the region. And, you know, then they would get this additional power generated from the regenerative braking. So this was, again, over a century ago that we're talking about at this point, and was simply, you know, almost lost to American society in a way.
Yeah, it's weird how all of our climate change problems were solved in 1915, and we've just been making, you know, backwards progress since then.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that I wanted to talk about. I had in my notes to ask you about. I mean, from a scientific perspective, from an engineering perspective, when we're thinking about the future of transportation, both economically and ecologically, it seems like this kind of electrification is the way to go. Instead, there's, you know, discussion about batteries and things like that, as opposed to just like, we know how to do this. Why aren't we doing it?
I mean, I think it's because, you know, just of a general sort of fear of, you know, putting money into capital improvements, you know, especially when, again, everyone's scared there's going to be some new disruptive technology, which is going to make something like electrification redundant. Right. And I don't know that you're going to have mainline battery powered trains, I would say at all, but certainly not anytime soon. They are doing some experiments now with a battery car that can be attached to a diesel locomotive to capture some of the regenerative braking on there, because diesel locomotives have regenerative brakes. It's just all that power is sent to radiators as opposed to, you know, being used for anything useful. This would redirect it to a battery. That's ultimately still a diesel locomotive, just with some extra. But yeah, I think, you know, just putting up the wires is something that needs to be done at some point, regardless if we're going to, if anyone's serious about climate change. You can't just keep improving the efficiency of diesel engines. You're still using diesel, right? I mean, the largest consumer of diesel fuel in the world is the U.S. Army, followed by Burlington Northern Santa Fe and Union Pacific.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's just this idea that there's disruptive technology around the corner. I mean, you know, if you listen to shows like Trash Future, it becomes very clear how much of that stuff is vaporous, right? It's that everyone's, yes. You know, you got these investors promising stuff that's right around the corner, and it's just completely made up. I mean, you know, in many ways, there's freight trucking. That would be a whole other episode to talk about, like kind of the impact that freight trucking had on railroads in terms of freight capacity and where things were being directed and so forth. But you know, that's another one where people are thinking about like, okay, well, what's the ecological way of doing all this trucking? Now, of course, you could say the ecological way would be to do a lot less shipping in general and have things yes. closer to where they need to be in the first place. But setting that aside, you know, you get companies that say, oh, you know, we're about to have a battery powered truck. And I'm sure there are people trying to make the same pitch in the realm of railroads. You know, we're about to have this battery powered technology. And then you find out that the company hasn't built anything. You know, their yes. videos are of them rolling a truck downhill on, you know, under gravity power and pretending that it's actually powered by a battery. I mean, it's fraudulent. And as you're kind of suggesting, the impact of that is not just, oh, haha, that's a weird scam that they're running. It's literally depriving us of stuff we know how to do in the moment, because you've convinced a bunch of the dumb capitalist people that we are just about to break through on some technology that will solve all of our problems, when in fact we're nowhere near getting it to it. And it's just, you know, endless press releases, basically. There's no substance to it, but it's distracting people from doing stuff that we know how to do in the moment. And it's taking away capital that could be invested in actual real projects instead of fake projects like the Hyperloop or whatever.
Yeah, it's bizarre because I've always, you know, I'm kind of skeptical of like battery powered transportation in general. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, I could see it working for consumer automobiles just because they spend 90% of their time parked and they can charge then. But if you have anything that has like a commercial like duty cycle, you know, you're wasting a lot of time charging when that vehicle could be out doing stuff. You know, it seems like refueling with gasoline or diesel would make a lot more sense then from an economic perspective. And that's why I'm kind of like, why don't we, if you do electrification with wires, that's a much better, you get much better economy than if you're having to order twice as many vehicles so that half of them can spend all their time, spend that time charging.
Well, you know, I don't know about your experience in local political lobbying, but I've heard people don't like overhead wires because they look bad.
I am told. Yes. I mean, here in Philadelphia, the SEPTA has been trying for a while to implement battery buses on trolley bus routes. And the net result of this is the trolley bus wires have fallen into disrepair and those lines are run by diesel buses.
Right. For listeners closer to me, trackless trolleys would be the term, you know, just to translate that for people. But actually, you know what? I'm not going to get into that because we should probably have you back on for a different episode about that, because that's driving me nuts every time you post about how they've, you know, try to replace the existing overhead wire buses with battery buses that then break immediately and then have to be replaced with diesel buses. It's just, I mean, it makes you go crazy. So we'll set that aside and keep our focus today on actual rail electrification, long distance rail electrification. One other thing before, you know, there was a few other points I was going to talk about in terms of kind of the after the sort of golden age period. But looking at that peak period, looking at that period from the 1890s to the late 1930s, there was one other question that was kind of sticking out a lot in my mind. So previously on your videos, you've talked about or your guests have talked about how the design of specific locomotives, primarily we're talking about steam locomotives in this case, was often in this period explicitly undertaken with labor costs and hostility to unions in mind. So for example, I think I recall either you or one of your guests talking about how certain steam locomotives would be designed with the objective of not needing as large of an operating crew, or changing the boiler fuel shoveling design to sort of smash the firemen's union. What were the labor implications of electrification in the early days before the dieselization period? Because it seems to me that there were some cases where they were saying, oh, look how many fewer locomotives we're using, and you don't need somebody shoveling coal, but at the same time they were often able to then increase their capacity, run more trains, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the labor efficiencies of electric locomotives compared to steam locomotives cannot be understated. I mean, a steam locomotive is a big labor intensive machine, right? Sometimes from like a cold start, a steam locomotive spends anywhere from 6 to 8 hours to get up to steam. So that's time you're paying someone to look after it while it's not doing anything, right? At the time, you needed a 5-man crew. There were 2 men up front, the engineer and a fireman. There were 3 men in the caboose. You know, so you always needed 2 people per locomotive in order to run them. So if you were double heading, triple heading, that was an additional 2 people you needed per locomotive, right? You know, they were complex machines that required a lot of skill to operate. Once you got these electric locomotives, you're going from a system where you need, you know, 3 or 4 different individual controls to control the speed of the locomotive. You're going to something where I turn a lever, it goes faster. I turn the lever back, it goes slower, right? You have multiple unit control where one guy can control an arbitrary number of locomotives at the same time. You know, there's incredible labor efficiencies compared to steam locomotives, which electric locomotives were able to cause. You had, you know, the you don't have people refueling them. You're spending a hell of a lot less time in the shop because a electric motor is a dead simple machine. You know, so now this ultimately, it does reduce the power of labor because, you know, you are using fewer people. You don't need an army of people to service this electric locomotive. You can have like a few people look at it once in a while. These locomotives were available even back in like the 1910s. They were able to run continuously for 355 days out of the year. You know, so obviously you get a lot of labor efficiency out of them. And of course that does inherently sort of de-skill labor and reduce the power of labor. Right now, I don't know if a good situation for increasing the power of labor is to go back to steam locomotives. I think that would probably not be good, as much as it would be extremely aesthetic.
Very cool. Yeah, I guess that's the thing, is that dieselization ended up doing a lot of the same things to labor in many ways. Yes. So converting from diesel to electric would not probably have the same impact that converting from steam to electric had, which understandably made some unions upset.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even then, you still have reduced maintenance costs on an electric locomotive versus a diesel. But the savings are not quite as significant, which I think is one of the things which, you know, sort of discourages mass electrification now, is that you don't have the enormous cost savings compared to what's already running.
Right, and that's sort of a tough break as well in terms of promoting electrification. And I guess we can actually talk about that, you know, we're talking about this in the environment of capitalism and the idea of needing the investment capital and so forth. So we should talk a little bit about that and kind of what happened toward the end. So in the first few decades of the 20th century, there was a lot of bold talk about how much electrification of rail was just around the corner. Most of that never came to be. A 1936 Federal Power Commission report cited in this book identified 20 railroads with some 12,000 miles of track that could be cost-effectively electrified. But electrification, as we said, peaked in 1938 at 6,300 miles. So that would have been like, you know, tripling the system, basically, and it just never happened. Now, we talked a little bit about, you know, the standardization things that were maybe an inhibition on electrification. But the bigger thing that seems to have been the problem and is going to probably still be a challenge today, now that we're not converting from steam, is that although the cost savings for operations at the time were huge after electrification, the upfront capital investments required to install electrification and buy new equipment was another huge hurdle. The Great Depression hit revenues hard, and hard enough that further electrification was largely dependent on federal government loans, but there weren't like a huge amount of federal dollars going into this. And the war then also slowed things despite big surges in freight traffic related to the war effort. And then by the post-war period, you start having diesel electric locomotives not that long after that. And they're basically electric trains, except that the power is generated on board with diesel fuel instead of remotely through overhead wire. In the aftermath of World War II, it was assumed that widespread electrification would resume almost immediately, and many projects were identified as possibilities, but none of them ever got built, and the U.S. was in 17th place in rail electrification by the early 1970s, after being the world leader in 1938. The Soviet Union had almost 20 times more electrified rail mileage, and after the war, there was not enough private capital flowing to these projects, and the newly proven diesel electric technology seemed like a cheaper stepping stone to electrification at some future date, and then they just never bothered after that. The other thing that we end up seeing is that dieselization actually allowed railroads to start rolling back previous electrification in places where it had been undertaken to avoid smoke from steam power rather than financial reasons. And in corporate mergers, as we alluded to earlier, between companies where one was electrified and one was not generally electrified, typically led to taking away electrified service in favor of standardization of diesel across the combined new systems. And the 1970s saw renewed interest in rail electrification between the rising traffic and the oil shock, but by the time the studies were done at the start of the 1980s, the price pressures against diesel had subsided again, and nothing really came of any of this. Actually, I thought it was kind of depressing in this book. This is the 2002 re-edition, and he kind of is like, well, here's a list of all the projects that never really happened over the decades since I published this book that had seemed really promising at the time. And here's a list in 2002 of all the projects that seem really promising now. I'm sure they'll get built in the next 5 or 10 years. And here we are in 2021, and that has not happened. So I was wondering kind of what your thoughts were on that kind of initial halting of electrification period and then outright retrenchment backward away from that. I mean, that again, that's how we get to this point where it almost feels like this sort of other world that we can't recognize, that there was this period of you know, at least some significant electrification, and then now it's hard to even imagine that.
It's interesting that, you know, we got so far and it looked like electric traction was going to be the way of the future, and just no one acted on it. I mean, the you know, once Electromotive Division came out with the F unit and the GP9, that was it. It was like, let's just use these on everything.
They do look cool.
They do look extremely good. Yes. But it's you know, it's just all this capital investment that was required up front. There was no help from the government coming, right? We didn't have a nationalized rail network like they had in a lot of Europe and a lot of other countries. We had a series of competing corporations, and those corporations, you know, they didn't even really like competing with each other too much. The thing that was, I thought we made a joke about this in the last episode, the thing that almost got us back on the electrification train was, of course, the oil shock, the Yom Kippur War. You know, and obviously, I guess what we need to force the private sector to electrify would be a good oil embargo. But you know, it's just depressing, really. We got so close, and then it just didn't happen. And so we're stuck with you know, these diesel electric locomotives, which are, they're pretty good, but they're not as good as they could be. You got railroads, which are, you know, they're more expensive to run than they need to be, and you have sort of, I mean, the whole capital costs issue in the United States, most of the English speaking world, is very strange, and I don't think anyone's quite pinned down yet what the reasons for it are. But stuff is way more expensive to do than it needs to be.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. A lot of this could have been done much less expensively in the mid-century. It almost seems like that leaving this to the hands of private capital was a bad idea, and we should have had a central government step in and do it and take out the competition and the short-termist incentives and put some government bonds behind that. Seems like that might have worked out better than the private sector doing this.
Yeah, it's definitely, it would have been a it would have been much better for, I mean, at the very least, have the government take some interest in, you know, the efficient operation of railroads, because if you've ever shipped by rail, you know that the railroads are not good at their only job, mm-hmm. Except for a few bulk cargoes and stuff like intermodal. The railroads do not like their customers, and the one thing you would like them to do, which is to deliver cars on time, and promptly and reliably, they are not very good at doing.
Yeah, well, that's probably a topic for a different episode as well. We could get into a whole thing about the deranged management of CSX and so forth, and
yes.
Just the absolute contempt for their customers and getting things. I mean, it seems like they think that sending cargo over their trains is an inconvenience to the business of running a railroad, which doesn't seem to include actually sending cargo from point A to point B.
I was about to say, I think the ideal railroad for a lot of these people is one with no trains whatsoever.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's sort of the general tendency of all corporations in the United States and North America at this point, right? The corporation is an inconvenient thing that has a lot of assets that you have to pay for over time and maintain, and it would be simpler if we just sold all of them and closed the business.
Yes.
One thing that was interesting, because you were saying that, you know, why didn't the U.S. take a strategic interest? And we've actually done an episode on this show a few years back about the World War One era, when the U.S. government stepped in and temporarily nationalized all the railroads because they did have a strategic interest in sort of their operation and also investing in getting them into better shape, because a lot of these companies had taken on so much private sector debt that they couldn't actually do the maintenance they needed to do. But there was another example. You know, we talked about the Milwaukee Road and its electrification, and I mean, talk about a railroad that had financial problems. But
yes.
One of their sort of iconic features of their electrification in the post-war period, at least before they, you know, fell into complete disrepair and eventually had to, you know, abandon everything and go bankrupt, was those Little Joe locomotives, the electric locomotives from GE that were intended for sale to the USSR until the US government banned it for Cold War reasons. I mean, first of all, we already just talked about how the Soviet Union ended up rapidly overtaking the U.S. in rail electrification mileage by a wide margin by the early 1970s. But also, this is kind of just very funny that they were like, well, surely banning a few locomotives from going to the USSR will strategically set back the USSR. Also, we will not be taking any efforts or steps in the United States to improve rail travel and transportation here. I mean, you know, I guess you'll get to buy some cheap locomotives from GE, but that's about it, right? I mean, they just completely one hand not talking to the other hand in the US government in the Cold War, when this was an obvious strategic thing that could have helped.
Yeah, I mean, the USSR's railroad network, a lot of people, when they say, well, why isn't our railroad network more like Europe, or why isn't our railroad network more like Japan? And, you know, I honestly think in terms of geography, what you need to kind of look at for an idea of efficient railroad operations at scale is Russia and the former Soviet Union.
Right.
You know, the fact that they are able to haul so much crap on those railroads is because of electrification. You know, the fact that you're able to run, you know, sort of freight and passenger trains efficiently on the same tracks, and, you know, they have very long freight trains there in addition to reliable passenger trains. The reason you're able to do that is electrification. You know, and of course, here in the United States, we decided, well, instead, we're going to build the interstate highway system, which is, of course, another reason why Russia relies a lot on rail travel, is they don't have an interstate highway system, at least not to speak of. I don't think it's possible to drive from one end of Russia to the other. I may be wrong about that. I am not sure.
Well, this is the part. If we were on your show, your co-host Alice would be playing the Soviet National Anthem audio drop at this point.
Yes.
So I guess as we wrap up here, I just wanted to, you know, was there anything else from the book that was sort of a point that you wanted to emphasize, or anything, you know, we kind of glossed over some of the early technological development. I don't know if you had any comments about that or any sort of the interesting points on that. I mean, you know, one of the things we've been talking a lot about on this show is sort of the differences between the first industrial revolution and the second industrial revolution. If you're talking about railroads, one of the big differences, of course, is this electrification period, at least in the second half of the second industrial revolution. Was there anything from the book that we sort of breezed through a little bit too quickly today and you wanted to emphasize for the listeners?
Well, I don't think we talked too much. We talked a lot about sort of mainline freight electrification. We didn't talk very much about like commuter trains or, you know, well, really mostly commuter trains.
Oh, yes. And self-propelled, right? I mean, that was a big thing.
Yeah. You're self-propelled. You're electric multiple units, you know, the stuff that really turns a commuter railroad into sort of more, almost rapid transit style operation. I mean, I think this is the biggest application right now for electrification, like immediately, is, you know, electrifying stuff like, let's say, the MBTA or stuff like the Virginia Railway Express, or, you know, commuter trains like that. That is, I feel like the most urgent need for electrification is in places like that, just because the trains will run so much faster and so much more efficiently without having to do anything to the track or the right of way itself. I mean, imagine if you could, if you could shave 20 minutes off a schedule just by electrifying, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about, you know, in Newton, where Newton, Massachusetts, where I'm a city councilor, I live near the Green Line, which is the, you know, light rail that used to be, you know, a New Haven commuter rail service. And the northern side of the city has a Purple Line commuter rail. And they've always, people are always saying, like, well, why can't we get, you know, electrification or at least rapid transit diesel or something? If you could, you know, shave that schedule down, you run basically shorter trains like on the light rail system. You run, you know, you have fewer passengers per train, but you can run them more frequently. And that also helps a lot of people, like, be able to just say, okay, I'm just going to go to the station and then there will be a train pretty soon. I mean, it wouldn't probably be quite the frequency that we have on the Green Line, but it would still be a lot more frequent as opposed to being like, all right, I got to wait 45 minutes now, hope it's not late. And, you know, if I missed it by a few minutes because I was late getting out of the house, now I'm screwed. Like, that could be, as you say, a huge boost to a lot of commuter rail systems in the country.
Yeah, and more frequent service isn't necessarily much more expensive to run than less frequent service, especially with some of the ways commuter trains are used in the United States, where you may have to buy one train for one trip each day because they spend the middle of the day sitting in a yard.
Anything else that you wanted to emphasize from this?
Trains are good. We should have more of them.
Well, that's certainly the official stance of this podcast as well. Well, as I said, I mean, there were so many different things that came up today that could have made their whole episodes on their own. I would certainly love to have you back on at some point to talk about that. Obviously, you know, streetcars is a whole other thing that we could talk about as well, especially as we're thinking about, you know, what to do in terms of automobiles from a climate change standpoint. You know, and you mentioned about the trackless trolleys, the trolley buses getting replaced badly in the Philadelphia system. Again, Justin Rozniak, my guest today, is the host of Well, There's Your Problem, and has a YouTube series about city skylines and various urban policy that he does on YouTube at Well, Do Not Eat 01. I'm going to try to put the links to various episodes that we've mentioned today in this. And the book that we were talking about today, again, is When the Steam Railroads Electrified, second edition from 2002 by William D. Middleton. Justin, is there anything else that you want to plug?
I think that's about it.
All right.
I think you covered everything.
Well, Justin Rozniak, thank you so much for coming on Arsenal for Democracy this week to talk about this.
Oh, no problem. I enjoyed it. I hope to come on again sometime. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, as a reminder, as always, I will have the links up with this episode. We always put up a PDF that has the links that we've talked about. In this case, it's going to also have a bunch of my notes from the book. You know, but usually we have a lot of detailed links to various sources if we're doing online research. So thank you all for listening. And thanks for people who are subscribing at our Patreon at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy.